Welcome back to episode 5 of Fresh from the Old Bailey, special season on the Constance Martin trial. Direct from the reporters who watch it play out every single day, the Court News team. With me as ever, I have Court News UK's star reporter, Jack Hudson.
Hello.
And company supremo, Guy Toyne.
Hello.
Regular guest, journalist for Stylist, Cosmo and other things, Alice Snape, cannot be with us today. The trial has now taken so long that she's had to go back to prior engagements. So, to recap the story so far, 15 months since baby Victoria was found dead inside the infamous Little Bag for Life, an elephantine stop-start trial that has played out in the Central Criminal Court is winding up into its final act. After 2 more days of testimony from Martin herself, closing arguments are upon us, starting with prosecutor Tom Little, KC. Within the next couple of days, they will end, the judge will sum up, and it will be for the jury to decide. From there, they could come back at any time, be it in days or in weeks. Jack, I'm afraid we're going to have to begin, as is tradition, by outlining the many tedious delays between here and our last episode, which was now a month ago. Roughly characterised, these delays were Easter, Eid, sick jurors. Anything else?
I think that's pretty much it. I think the delays we've had have more been planned delays now. So obviously this trial was meant to end on the 8th of March. It was meant to be a 6-week trial. We are now in week 12 of that 6-week trial. So the jurors have commitments and they are being allowed to keep them because they were never told they were meant to be here this long. So we've had whole weeks. For example, the week after Easter, we didn't sit at all. So yes, it's been a lot more stop-start, a bit less of a flow. We're not in there every day now. But it is now coming to an end. And we've had the prosecution closing speech. We've had the prosecution speech for Gordon. So all that we've got left is the prosecution closing speech for Martin, which is going to take place tomorrow. And then the judge will sum up the case and the jury may go out this week.
So the last time we spoke, Constance Martin was in the midst of a multi-day testimony that you described as astounding at the time. She did another day of that. Thereafter, we heard from an expert, a paediatrician called Professor Fleming. What was he talking about?
So Professor Fleming was developing on the arguments that the pathologists had made previously. And he was called by Martin's barristers. And he's a respected expert. He has gained a CBE for his work on cot deaths. His opinion was that there's no evidence that the baby died of hypothermia, and that from all the evidence that he's seen, which included interviewing Constance Martin himself, he thinks her account of what happened is the most likely cause of death, that being that she fell asleep on the baby and smothered the baby. He was challenged very robustly by Tom Little, the prosecutor, who felt that he had just accepted everything that Constance Martin had told him. And Tom Little put that to him and mentioned Constance Martin's other lies, the fact that she has admitted lying to other medical professionals, and asked how he could be sure that she was telling him the truth, to which Professor Fleming said that it's not really his job to cross-examine someone, and that when he talks to a grieving parent, he normally accepts their account unless he has a reason not to.
When you hear the closing speeches in any court case, you often hear for the first time the prosecution really lay out their case, because of course then they would have had the opportunity to see one or more of the defendants give evidence. And in this case, what Tom Little has said is that the reason that Mark Gordon didn't give evidence was because the two of them, Gordon and Martin, had worked out between them that it would be easier for Constance Martin to lie about what happened and not be caught out. So what he means by that is, if you are cross-examining one person on something the other one has said when that other person was present at the time, or something that that person has done, it's obviously going to be a lot easier just to say, this is what happened, and not have a second person to trip up. Because this is exactly how barristers work if they have more than one defendant. They'll try and say, well, your co-defendant said, and you're saying this, why is that? And then we have this endless thing, you'll have to ask them. So in this case, Tom Little is now saying that Constance Martin is a liar. And he's saying that she has lied to the jury over and over and over again. And in fact, he's come out with some quite choice phrases to describe that lying. One of the phrases is, the lies are falling from her mouth like confetti. Nice touch. The other one is, I think he says that she's been telling big fat lies. And all, as his case is, to cover up the fact that they were grossly negligent when they were looking after this child. And one of the key things they've been lying about, according to the prosecution, obviously it's a matter for the jury to decide, is that Constance Martin says that she gave birth a certain amount of time before she actually did. Now, the idea of this, or the prosecution case of why she is lying, is because she's trying to cover up the fact that the child died of hypothermia, not what Constance Martin says, that basically one night she woke up in the morning, uh-oh, I've got a dead baby. Okay. Obviously, if the child has died of hypothermia, then it's much easier to prove that the couple, or one of them, again, it's a matter for the jury, has been grossly negligent in their care of that child. And some of the evidence that Tom Little has been pulling out, okay, to back up that assertion or that allegation of gross negligence, is the fact that the kid had no clothes. He said he's pulled out the fact that there wasn't even, apparently the baby didn't even have a hat. We've heard, of course, there was that infamous moment when the car exploded on the M61. Apparently, taking up a load of bundles of used notes inside the car. But also, apparently, lost in the car were a load of the children's clothes as well. That's what their claim is. So what he's trying to say is, all this stuff about the clothes being lost in the car, really, it's not true. Because what it is the fact that they're just trying to cover up for the fact they were grossly negligent. They couldn't even be bothered to find adequate clothes for that baby in a very harsh winter. Now, of course, that's the prosecution case. And as I keep saying, it's a matter for the jury to decide. That's their allegation. Constance Martin says, of course, that she did everything she possibly could to look after that child as best she could. You know, we've seen the footage of her walking around with the anorak with the baby inside, stuffed with bits of old furniture stuffing. And she says this is basically her doing the very best she can. So we're really seeing now, if you like, Tom Little, the prosecutor, taking the gloves off and saying, members of the jury, she's a liar.
He's characterised her as a liar. Has he put that in any broader context as to who she is as a person? Is there a kind of a bigger story here about why all of this happened?
It's quite interesting that he's pulled down an analogy that only listeners from the 1970s will understand. And he said it's an upstairs-downstairs thing. Now, some of us may remember the wonderful TV series in the mid-1970s, starring, of course, the tremendous Gordon Jackson as Mr. Hudson, the butler. When the car, so say, exploded on the M61, the person, a witness who attended the scene, was a Mr. Hudson. And what the prosecutor has said is that Constance Martin has an upstairs, downstairs attitude. And what he means about by that is that basically she, as coming from a blue blood aristocratic family, is very, very snotty. And she's saying that basically she was very, very snotty in the way that she treated these witnesses. She referred to the Hudsons as random workmen. And what Mr. Little said was, you may think that suggests an obvious sense of misunderstanding, almost an upstairs, downstairs mentality. Mr. Hudson, the witness at the car, actually put his hands on the baby's head, according to him, and said, God bless, keep safe. And Constance Martin was told the jury that didn't happen. And Mr. Little said, well, she's lied to you about why that random workman touched the baby's head. And he went on to say that it's another lie. And in one of those flowery phrases that he's been coming out with, it's a constellation of lies.
So Mr. Little has talked about Constance Martin's lies over and over. And he's referred to the lies that she has admitted telling. He also, of course, says that she's lying about most of her account to the jury. And he's also tried to demonstrate some specific lies that she's told. So Martin has claimed that she had multiple items for baby Victoria, that she had a quilt, that she had a hat, that she had multiple items of clothing. But these were never found in the little bag for life with Victoria's body. And what Mr. Little said is, surely you would keep all of the clothes that had been worn by a baby who passed away. And he also tried to demonstrate some other lies. So he talked about the buggy, which was bought by the couple in an Argos in London. And he said that, so when Constance Martin gave evidence, the buggy was produced in court, not the actual buggy, but the same buggy from Argos. And when the buggy was brought forward by the court usher to Martin, she said, no, that's not the buggy, you've got the wrong one. Because Martin was saying that the buggy she purchased came with what she called a sub-zero sleeping bag. And that is one of the items they used to keep Victoria warm and one of the items they had in the tent. A police officer was then called to give evidence and said that they'd gone to the Argos where Gordon had been. Only one person had bought a buggy in cash during that time. They found out what buggy it was. The buggy had been discontinued by Argos. So they went online, they found a second-hand version, and it was the same buggy. And what Mr. Little said in his closing speech was that if Martin had had a real objection to the buggy, she would have brought forward, she would have got her barristers to bring forward a different buggy. And he said it was unchallenged evidence and that she'd been caught out in a lie. So his point was that Constance Martin would lie indignantly about many topics, some big and some small, and that the jury couldn't trust her testimony, that she was a completely unreliable witness. He also said that she would sometimes latch on to aspects of truth, which he said was the sign of a good fraudster, that she would latch on to an aspect of truth but twist and warp it. For example, we've heard in an agreed fact that Constance Martin's parents admit that they did have her followed by private investigators in 2016, 2017, and 2021 for a period of a few weeks each time to find her. And he says that she has taken that aspect of truth and said that she was being made it seem like she was being followed by what he called Mission Impossible style private investigators in 2022 and 2023 as well.
So that took about a day. And thereafter, we haven't heard from Constance Martin's barrister in rebuttal yet, but we have heard a closing argument from Mark Gordon's barrister. How did that go?
We've heard John Famiola, Mark Gordon's barrister, make his closing speech. And it's been interesting in a way because he spent a lot of time talking about Constance Martin. I suppose it's easier to talk about Constance Martin in a way because, of course, Mark Gordon hasn't given evidence. But he did say some incredible things about her, to be quite honest with you. He did spend some time discussing how the name Constance is derived from the Latin. Apparently, it's rooted in the Latin Constantia. And as Mr. Famiola told us all, it means steadfastness, resolute, faithful, loyal, dedicated, and perseverance, no matter what the obstacle. Well, fascinating that is. And he said that she gave her evidence posh but polite, you may think. Calm and intelligent. And she was steadfast under cross-examination. She was resolute and her deep, deep love for her children overflowed. He said that she was a strong woman, someone that she couldn't be pushed around. He referred to her children as her cubs. And that basically he referred to her as a lioness, defending her cubs, all very, very flowery indeed. But one thing that he did also say, which is, I suppose, one of the keys to this case, is that she said, Constance Martin said, that her family were embarrassed about her relationship with Mark Gordon, and of course, the fact that she had four children with Mark Gordon.
So the figure of Mark Gordon seems to be getting a bit lost in this trial. Obviously, he didn't testify on his own behalf. And from what I've heard from you, it sounds like his barrister's closing argument was mainly about Constance. Did we get any more assertions about Mark Gordon's role within this case?
Well, a barrister can't give evidence and they can only talk about the evidence the jury's already heard. So obviously, Mr. Famiola is making a speech for his client who hasn't given any evidence to the jury himself. So there is a limited amount that Mr. Famiola can say. But he did try and offer some explanations. He tried to offer an explanation for Mr. Gordon's police interview, which Mr. Little had said that in Gordon's police interview, he basically wasn't answering the questions. He avoided the questions. And Mr. Little said that was because he didn't know exactly what Constance Martin had told the police and he didn't want to contradict what he said were her lies. What Mr. Famiola said was he went to the transcript of the police interviews and he said that the police officer who was interviewing Gordon had made two big mistakes when the police officer summarised what Constance Martin had already told the police to Mark Gordon. So the police officer had told Gordon that Constance Martin had said the baby had died when it was 3 days old, which she hadn't in fact done. And the police officer had also told Mark Gordon that Constance Martin had said that the baby died because they both her and Gordon fell asleep on top of the baby. And Constance has not in fact said that. She'd said that she fell asleep on top of the baby. So what Mr. Famiola said was that it was possible that Gordon had heard that from the police officer and thought, why is Constance saying that? And he hadn't wanted to throw his partner, who he loves, under the bus. And that was why he didn't answer the police questions and said he wouldn't speak until he got caught. Obviously, he then did not speak when he got caught. He hasn't told the jury his testimony. But Mr. Famiola said that that had maybe made the issues clearer for the jury and they can focus on what really matters, which was, did this baby experience cold stress and die? Which he said it did not.
And obviously there's no duty on him to testify in his own behalf, and his barrister doesn't need to posit a reason as to why or why not.
No, and Mr. Famiola repeated that to the jury and said that it was his choice not to give evidence and they mustn't hold that against him.
So tomorrow, all being well, we'll hear from Constance Martin's barrister and their closing arguments. And thereafter there is the judge's summing up. And once that is done, it will be up to the jury to finally decide. So to take our listeners slightly behind the scenes, how does a jury decide, Jack? You've been through a lot of cases. What is the basic protocol in terms of them entering that room and beginning that process?
So the judge will finish his summing up. We expect that to be by the end of this week. And then he will tell them that the time has come to go out and begin their deliberations. So the usher in this case is Joe, who's the usher to the Recorder of London, who, in my opinion, is the best Crown Court usher in the country, mainly because she's been providing the barristers and journalists with Percy Pigs and Culling the Caterpillars throughout the trial. But she will come forward and she will take an oath that she will keep the jury in some private place, that she will not suffer any person to speak to them, nor will she speak to them herself until they are agreed on their verdict. And then she will transform from being a court usher and she will become a jury bailiff. And she will then take the jury out through the door, which is next to the judge's seat, and she will take them to a deliberations room. Unusually in this case, the jury already have had a room. So most of the juries at the Old Bailey don't get a room until they begin their deliberations. In this case, the jury has had its own room throughout where they have been during the case and where they are allowed to talk about the case when all 11 of them are present. So they have already had some time. They already do go out of that exit, but they will go out there and then they will go into the deliberations room. They will elect a foreperson and they will start their discussions.
It used to be years ago that jurors, if they, on the rare occurrence that they couldn't decide on the day, because you have to remember that juries, for whatever reason, deliberate for far, far longer than they used to. If they couldn't decide on the day, they would be go off to a hotel. So they would be all kept together. And many jurors used to think this was a fantastic opportunity for some high jinks and, how can I say, a bit of luxury on the taxpayers' expense. Unfortunately, when they arrived at the hotel they were assigned to, they'd often get a bit of a rude shock because some of them were, how can I say, the less salubrious hotels. It's a good question as to what goes on behind closed doors during jury deliberations. This is a question which has taunted the hearts and minds of good men and women since time immemorial. Some of the verdicts that juries come up with are, of course, slightly bewildering, in that some cases you would imagine they would find one verdict, and of course they find completely the other. Having said that, it is true that the jury system is probably the best way of deciding a case, because you wouldn't want barristers to decide for you, would you? I believe jurors are shown a short film before they start deliberating, or CCTV or video or whatever, and they are discouraged, actively discouraged, from having the classic 12 angry men show of hands. So even if a jury goes in to deliberations and they are all convinced, let us say, of a defendant's guilt, they are supposed to have a good old chat about that before they all decide. Nevertheless, you do get some cases where jurors come back very quickly, within an hour. Unfortunately, nowadays, that's extremely rare. And of course, you get cases where jurors stay out deliberating and endlessly turning over the evidence for weeks and weeks and weeks. And sometimes, of course, things get slightly fractious in the jury room. We had one case at the Old Bailey recently where one juror and another juror fell out during discussions. And there was a little bit of shenanigans in the lift, and I believe one juror poked the other. And this led to the person who was poked, as it were, promising a demonstration of her kung fu skills if the other juror was interested. This did cause a few problems, but they were able to reach a verdict in the end anyway.
Did you have access to more? So this jury will be given a microchip and there'll be a computer in the deliberation room and they'll be able to watch back any of the CCTV that's been played in the case, which is quite extensive. They can also request any of the exhibits, for example, the pram. They can get the pram in the jury room and have another look at that. They can even ask for the tent to be put up in the jury room if they want to climb in there again. So there is plenty they can be doing.
Of course, one might suppose that the reason that juries take greater time in their deliberations is because they somehow take more care than they used to. Without referring to John Reginald Christie, the serial killer, again, as of course we must do, the jury in that case, and of course, if they convicted, Christie would hang, took 40 minutes. One thing, some of my predictions on this case have not come true. However, one prediction I can make with a degree of confidence is that this jury will take a lot longer than 40 minutes. As Jack says, jurors do have a lot more, bits of evidence to play with nowadays. So CCTV, perhaps. In other cases, of course, we have interminable mobile telephone evidence. But this jury in particular has taken very strong interest in the evidence, as shown by a number of questions which the jury have asked. And I believe at the last count, we've had something like 150 notes to the judge. So I think we're in for quite a long period of deliberation in this one.
Yes, so the judge has already given the jury what we call legal directions, and this tells them exactly what they will have to consider when they are going through each count on the indictment. So we have five counts in this trial, and those are concealment of the birth of a child cruelty, manslaughter by gross negligence, causing or allowing the death of a child, and perverting the course of justice. So what the judge has said is that they will have to consider count one first, and that is concealment of the birth of a child. And so this offence is not just about not registering a child birth or keeping the birth of a child secret. It's also about disposing of the child's body. So it's effectively concealing that a child was ever born or ever existed. So the first thing the jury would have to consider on that count is if a child had been born. In this case, that's not in dispute, because Martin did give birth to Victoria. They would then have to decide if the defendants tried to conceal the birth. And the judge reminded them of the evidence they've heard on that, which is that the birth was kept secret from absolutely everyone. Only this couple knew that that child had been born. So there isn't too much to decide on that point either. The third point is the one that is an issue, and that is that they secretly disposed of the dead body of the child. So what the prosecution say, what Mr. Little said in his closing speech, was, what on earth is their defence to this? They put the child's body in that little bag for life in a shed. What the defendants say is that it was not a secret disposition. They had not left the body in the shed for it never to be found. They'd left the body in the shed because they were going to a shop to buy food. They were returning, and there was no intention to hide the body. So that is what they will have to consider on count one. They will then move on to count two, which is child cruelty. They will have to decide that the defendants had responsibility for a baby who was under the age of 16. That's not in dispute. They will then have to decide whether the defendants willfully neglected or exposed the baby. So in this case, that means neglect, or exposed means exposure to the elements, exposure to the cold. So the jury would have to decide if they are sure that Gordon and Martin either neglected the baby, or that they're sure that the baby was exposed to cold conditions. And that is, would be how they decide.
So in this case, the judge, who is Judge Mark Lewcraft, the Recorder of London, when he was giving his directions to the jury, he told them that they must put sympathy or emotion aside and take a fair, careful and reasoned approach to the evidence. What he's saying here is that in a case like this, where the case is about the death of a very young child, it could be possible that some members of the jury allow their feelings of perhaps revulsion or anger at what happened to that child to overcome their dispassionate view of the evidence. And the way they must consider this case is on the evidence that they have heard in the case. And they have to try their very best to put any feelings of maybe sympathy for the defendants even, but certainly any feelings of concern for the child in a non-evidential sense, they have to put that behind them and consider the case solely on the facts that they have heard put before them in evidence.
Okay, so we've heard now the first two of the five charges that the judge instructed the jury over. It was concealing the birth of a child, firstly, and then child cruelty, secondly. What were the final three?
Yes, so if the jury find the defendants not guilty on the charge of child cruelty, then they will disregard counts three and four. Because if they find that there was no cruelty to Victoria, that she was not neglected and she was not exposed to cold, then obviously her death was not caused by neglect, because they found that no neglect happened. So that would be the end of it. But if they found her, if they find them guilty on count two, they would then move on first to count four, which is manslaughter by gross negligence. So that charge alleges that the defendants owed Victoria a duty of care and that they breached that care in a way that was grossly negligent, and that that is what caused her death. So there's no dispute that the defendants owed Victoria a duty of care. The jury will have to consider if they breached that duty of care and if it was foreseeable that that breach would give cause to an obvious or serious risk of death for baby Victoria, and they would have to decide that that breach is what caused her death. There's also a further test for this, and what the judge said to the jury was that they would have to consider whether the breach amounted to gross negligence, and he said that mistakes, even very serious mistakes, are nowhere near enough to amount to the commission of a criminal offence as manslaughter. What is meant by gross negligence is that if the previous four elements of the offence have been proved, the conduct of the defendant you are considering was so exceptionally bad that you, the jury, as representatives of the public, are of the view that it deserves to be regarded as going beyond any requirement for monetary compensation, and that it amounts to criminal behaviour on their part, which as such merits punishment. And he said that that was a very high bar which the prosecution must cross. And what the prosecution have said is that if baby Victoria died, as they say she did, of hypothermia after days and days in the cold tent, then that would clearly meet the test and that would be grossly negligent. So if the jury were to find the defendants guilty of manslaughter, they would then not consider count three, which is causing or allowing death of a child, because that is only there as an alternative count if they find them not guilty of manslaughter. So if they were to find the defendants not guilty, they would move on to consider causing or allowing the death of a child. And that's a slightly more complicated offence, but it basically means that either baby Victoria died as a result of the act of one of the defendants, and that there was a significant risk of harm being caused by that act, which would be causing the death of a child. Or it could mean that Victoria died as a result of an unlawful act of the other defendant, and that the defendant ought to have been aware of that risk and failed to take steps to prevent it. So what the prosecution have said on this count is that if the jury believe Constance Martin's account, and if they acquit her of manslaughter, acquit both the defendants of manslaughter, because they are not sure Victoria died of hypothermia, and they move on to causing or allowing death of a child, they say that even on Martin's own account, she would have caused the death of Victoria by falling asleep on top of her. Gordon would have allowed the death of a child because he knew that they were sleeping in unsafe conditions and he failed to stop it. Obviously, what the defendants say is that Victoria's death was purely an accident, that it could have happened to any parents who were co-sleeping with a baby. And they've made the point again and again that co-sleeping is not illegal, that Martin was breastfeeding her baby and she fell asleep by accident on top of it, that Gordon was asleep and that there was nothing he could have done to stop that from happening. And then the last count for the jury to consider is doing acts intending to pervert the course of justice. So they must be sure that there was a police investigation ongoing, which there was. And then they must be sure that the defendants did a series of acts which had a tendency to pervert the course of justice and that they intended to do so. This was another area where the prosecution seemed to say, what on earth is the defence? Because they say that Constance Martin, in her evidence, said that she knew there was a police investigation and that she talked about wanting to cremate Victoria and wanting to get rid of the evidence. What the defence say is that there was no intent to pervert the course of justice, that no acts were committed to get rid of evidence, and that is what the jury will have to decide.
So that was quite a dense and particular set of legal directions. This has been a slog of a case. It's been elephantine, as we said at the start. We'll only be coming back for one, maybe two further episodes of the show for the verdict and the sentencing. Given that it's a month since the last episode, if you were a betting man, Guy Toyne, how long do you think the jury might take?
The way that the trial has gone on for double its estimate is quite extraordinary, really. It's certainly no fault of the judge, who I think has struggled manfully, as it were, to keep the trial on the rails. You have to remember that, of course, if for whatever reason this trial is lost, if some procedure is not followed properly, then we'll all have to come back and have a retrial. And believe you me, no one wants this. So hopefully we'll have a couple of days deliberation, and then the jury will, having considered all the evidence they've heard in the court case, come to the just verdict.